Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada.
Some of you know our next speaker. He's here tonight in Vancouver to help celebrate Sven Robinson's 25 years, and we're very grateful to both him and Sven that the guy who I'm about to introduce was able to come and speak to us today to address us as we wage peace. He's chronicled for all of us for decades the massive crimes carried out covertly and overtly by the empire makers, by the war makers and the profiteers. He's helped us to dissect and analyze the lying corporate media that keep us in the chains of ignorance. And he's helped us, along with other writers and other activists and intellectuals, to break those chains. It is my very, very great honor and privilege to introduce to you, the people of Vancouver, Dr. Noam Chomsky.
Thanks. Well, after that nice introduction, I can't avoid opening by quoting from the lying corporate media, which I got a clip from. I don't know how many tens of thousands of talks I've given over the last 40 years, but I've learned that when I don't have time to prepare a talk, the easiest way to arrange it is just to read the morning's newspapers. And that almost it never fails. There's always something there that you can talk about. So this morning's no exception. Jack just introduced me without thinking about it. This is the Globe and Mail. I didn't hear Bush this morning, but I did read his talk from yesterday. And it's interesting and worth thinking about, and the report is interesting. It begins by saying that George Bush called the broader war on terror the inescapable calling of our generation, warning that human civilization itself is at stake. Okay. Now, he doesn't remember because he was probably drunk at a frat party at Yale at the time, but the people around him and his speechwriters and handlers remember very well that they wrote the same words for his colleagues over 20 years ago, back in 1981, when they came into office, pretty much the same people, and immediately opened by declaring a war on terror, which was, their words, the plague of the modern age. A war against civilization itself, which we had to battle relentlessly. And they fought that war on terror for the first 12 years they were in office, and they've picked it up again. And if we want to have any idea what they're doing, we should have a look at the 12 years in which they waged the war on terror. It was a real one. Our friend from the FMLN can tell us about it. They were one of the prime targets of the war on terror. Actually, his talk reminded me of a painting I have in my office, given to me by a Jesuit priest who painted it. It's a painting of the angel of death holding a scythe. And below him is a portrait of Archbishop Romero. His assassination opened that great decade. Alongside of him are the six Jesuit intellectuals who were murdered, had their brains blown out, ending the decade of the War on Terror, and their housekeeper and her daughter who were caught in the crossfire. That frames the decade on terror pretty well. And there's a side comment to make about it. I've had it for years. And I've noticed that everyone who comes into my office, everyone from south of the Rio Grande who comes into my office knows exactly what it is. And virtually no one from the United States, or I'm sorry to say Canada, knows what it is. We don't pay attention to our own crimes. We don't count them up. We don't. They don't exist. That's a war against terror. And El Salvador was only one target. They only had about 70,000 people slaughtered in the War on Terror. The rest of Central America added up to who knows. Since we don't count, we don't know. Maybe 200,000. And they're real achievements. Somebody has a sign there saying Bush is the real terrorist. Well, actually, he's a convicted terrorist, he and his accomplices. It's the only government in history that has been condemned by the World Court for international terrorism, namely the attack against the war on against Nicaragua. Would have been condemned by the Security Council, except that the U.S. vetoed two resolutions with Britain kindly abstaining, condemned repeatedly by the General Assembly. But it doesn't matter, because it's air crimes, so it's not terrorism. And Central America is only one of the places where they waged the war on terror. They also waged it, for example, in Southern Africa. There was, during the Reagan years, there was a policy called constructive engagement with Southern Africa, the Southeast African apartheid regime. During just those years, constructive engagement, the South African regime killed about 1.5 million people and caused about $60 billion of damage in the surrounding countries alone. Forget what was happening in South Africa. Well, the moderate, who is now the Secretary of State, he comes out of central casting as a moderate, was the National Security Advisor toward the end when the worst atrocities were being carried out. And the Pentagon in 1988 declared Nelson Mandela's African National Congress to be one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. This was at the time when the Reagan administration, the guys now in office, were finding ways to circumvent the congressional sanctions against aid and trade with South Africa, which they were able to increase, while the press, what was it, the corporate lying press, since I'm quoting it, I don't have to take responsibility for it. They quietly managed not to see what was happening. And the same was going on in the Middle East. The same was going on in Southeast Asia with Canada's very strong support during the near genocide in East Timor. And we can go on. That was the first war on terror, the war to save civilization from the plague of terror, assault by barbarians who are about to destroy civilization. So there's really nothing new is going on. The speechwriters can just plagiarize. In fact, it's the same words. Louder? Can't hear me? Oh, okay. Sorry. If you can't hear me, you can join my wife. She always complains. She always complains that I'm mumbling. She can't hear me. Actually, she actually went to a doctor who pays attention to your ears, I forget, to find out if she was losing her hearing. And he gave her a hearing test. And he asked her why she thought so. And she said she could never hear her husband. And he gave her the test and said, well, your husband's mumbling. Just leave it. So sorry if you can't hear me. The war on terror is very much like this one in other respects, many other respects, not just what's happening in Iraq. And it's worth paying attention to it. You know, we're not supposed to pay attention to what we've done in the past for good reasons. You learn too much. But we don't have to follow those rules. It's what schools are for, and journals and so on, but we don't have to follow him. The first war on terror began in 1981, and you'll remember there was another brave cowboy back then. He was hiding in the White House, surrounded by tanks in 1981 to protect him from the Libyan hitmen who were roaming the streets of Washington trying to assassinate our leader. Luckily, he managed to escape. 2 years later, in 1983, he sent 6,000 special forces to Grenada, where they got 8,000 medals of honor for having overcome the resistance of a couple of dozen Cuban construction workers. They were... Still can't hear me? You're making me feel like I'm in my living room or my wife can't hear me. I'm up to 1983 when the United States was seriously threatened, much worse than Saddam Hussein. There was in Grenada, the nutmeg capital of the world, there was an airbase being built from which, by the British, but didn't matter, from which the Russians might bomb us. And that's a serious threat. Most Americans probably thought Grenada was in Africa somewhere, but in fact it's pretty close. Fortunately, the cowboy sent 6,000 special forces who overcame the resistance of a couple of dozen construction workers, killed 40 or 50 of one another in the process, and got 8,000 medals of honor. And we were standing tall, as the president said, saved by the courage of the cowboy. A year later, a national emergency was declared in the United States with words that should be familiar from last year. In fact, the wording of the declaration of the national emergency was approximately the same as the wording of the congressional authorization for the war in Iraq. Almost the same. Reagan declared a national emergency because of the unusual and extraordinary threat to the security of the United States posed by the government of Nicaragua, which was 2 days' driving time from Texas. And as the Secretary of the State said, they were waving their copies of Mein Kampf as they were coming to conquer us. But somehow we escaped that one, too. Then came others, including domestic ones. George Bush, number one, was elected in 1988 on a race card, straight. He's going to save your sister from being raped by black criminals, Willie Horton, if you remember. That was, you got to be afraid of that one. There's nothing new going on. This is just a repetition of a very familiar formula. If you're shafting people, and they were shafting the population, they suffered badly in those years, you got to frighten them. There's no other known way to keep population under control. And it's happening now. It's happening now. This article goes on to describe the president's criticism of the Spanish. And that's an interesting one. He's criticizing Spain, and the article reads, it's a warning to Spain where leaders have threatened to withdraw their troops from Iraq. That's the conventional falsification, and a very interesting one. The Spanish prime minister didn't threaten to withdraw his troops from Iraq. He threatened to withdraw his troops from U.S. command in Iraq. That's quite a difference, and a crucial difference. In fact, what the press should be reporting is that the Spanish people took exactly the same position as the vast majority of the people of the United States, who as far back as last April were saying U.S. ought to get out. This is whatever happened for it or against it. This should be under the administration of the United Nations until you can turn it over to the people of Iraq. Well, that's what the people of Spain voted for the other day. So there's unity between the people of Spain and the people of the United States, but you're not going to find it described in the lying corporate media. We're not supposed to know that. We're not supposed to know that, but we should. It's important. And that's what the war is about right now. I mean, you can think whatever you like about what happened, but the issue now, and since the bombs start falling, is who is going to rule Iraq? And with all the vacillations of policy of the United States and before them Britain and Canada quietly in the background, with all the vacillations of policy, that's been the issue for over 80 years. Britain created Iraq. It wasn't a country. They drew the boundaries so that they could get the oil of the north and not the Turks, and so that the new country would be under their control because it wouldn't have access to the sea. That's why Kuwait was put in there, the Principality of Kuwait, to block access to the sea so the new country would be a client. Actually, what they called it was an independent state. It had a parliament and a constitution and all sorts of nice things. But the British, in their own internalments, said it's an Arab facade that the British would rule behind various constitutional fictions. That was in secret. But the Iraqis certainly knew about it. Question is, who's going to... In the case of Kuwait, the British refused to give it even nominal sovereignty until it looked like it was going to get out of control in 1958, at which point they said, okay, it can have its own post office. But secretly, Britain and the United States agreed that the British would have the right, in their words, ruthlessly to intervene if anything got out of control, internally or anywhere else. And the U.S. reserved the same right to ruthlessly intervene in the bigger countries, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, U.S. takes the big ones, Britain's allowed the little one. That's the way the game works. Canada picks up some contracts on the side. I won't run through the whole story, but it continues without a change. In 1975, the United States and Britain strongly supported the Iraqi government when it massacred Kurds, huge massacre of Kurds. Henry Kissinger was asked about this in congressional testimony, and he said, yeah, we did it, but you have to understand that foreign policy shouldn't be confused with missionary work. You've got to admire Kissinger for his honesty. He's usually quite straightforward. As soon as Saddam Hussein came in, Britain and the United States, of course, immediately supported him. In 1982, the U.S. took Iraq off the terrorist list, had been on the terrorist list. It was taken off in 1982 so that the U.S. could provide him freely with arms, badly needed agricultural aid, dual-use technology to produce weapons of mass destruction, and continue to support him right through the worst atrocities. Now you hear Bush and Blair and Rice and other hypocrites talking about the terrible atrocities and the mass graves and so on and so forth. Yeah, they knew all about it, and they continued to support him. It had nothing to do with the war in Iran. It continued without a change after that war was over. They continued to support him because it didn't matter. He was a valued ally and was good for U.S. Business, as they pointed out. We'll continue to support him while he gasses Kurds and tortures dissidents and does anything he'd like. In 1982, when he was taken off the terrorist list, they had an empty spot, so they had to put someone in. So they put Cuba in. Cuba was put in as a terrorist state, I presume, in response to the fact that there had just been a sharp escalation in the wave of U.S.-backed terror against Cuba that's been going on since 1959. It had peaked in the late 70s, shooting down airliners, ships, bombing embassies, and so on. So, yeah, Cuba had to be put on the terrorist list once Saddam was removed, still there. In 1991, that was a crucial time. In 1991, Saddam probably would have been overthrown. there was a rebellion in the South, would have overthrown him. The U.S. was in total control of the area. It was after the war. They basically authorized Saddam to crush the uprising, and furthermore, they explained why. You don't have to go to secret documents. You can read it in the New York Times. The New York Times explained that it was right to support Saddam to crush the uprising because Saddam offered more hope for stability in the region than the people who were trying to overthrow him. Thomas Friedman, whose rantings you can still read, explained that, as he put it, the best of all worlds for the United States would be an iron-fisted military junta which would rule Iraq the same way Saddam did, but not with his name. He was a little embarrassing by then. But since we can't get the best of all worlds, we'll have to do with the second best, namely Saddam himself. That was 1991. Then comes 10 years of sanctions, which we're not supposed to think about. The reason we're not supposed to think about them is that they, you know, by the most conservative measures, they killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, devastated the society, strengthened the tyrant, compelled the population to rely on him for survival. Otherwise, he probably would have been overthrown a long time ago by the population of Iraq. He would have gone the same way as the list of other gangsters that the same people supported. That's quite a rogue's gallery, like Suharto. You know all about that. Canada helped support him. He was ranked easily with Saddam Hussein, overthrown from within. Ceausescu, you know, as grotesque as you can get, supported to the last minute by the people now in Washington, Bush 1 administration, overthrown from within. Marcos, Duvalier, Mobutu, you know, quite a long list, and in fact new names are constantly being added. Overthrown from within, not Saddam. Why? Because the society was devastated. You had to rely on him just for mere survival. But the same principle, Iraq can't be run by Iraqis. And so it continues at this moment. The people of Iraq are, I'm not talking about the bombers, I'm talking about the general population, are steadfastly refusing to be returned to the colonial status that the current imperial overlord is preparing for them. And it's quite a struggle. You know, it's a the important thing for us is that it's a struggle that we can determine the outcome. It's outrageous to leave it to the people of Iraq to fight this battle. I mean, we can applaud them for doing it and praise them for their courage, but we should look in the mirror and not praise what we see. We should be stopping it. There's no reason why we can't prevent. Why we can't prevent the crime that is being carried out. And it's not in the front pages. You know, it's not a matter of bombing a hotel and this and that and the other thing. It's just this systematic refusal to accept the orders that are being imposed by the proconsul, Paul Bremer of the Pentagon, to try to prevent a democratic evolution in which the people of Iraq will take control of their own country. Some of the most extreme and grotesque measures are actually just economic. The orders which open the Iraqi economy up to foreign takeover by U.S., Canadian, British multinationals. I mean, that undermines any hope for authentic democracy and sovereignty and also for economic development. Well, we don't have to sit here and watch that. You know, those orders are coming from our governments. We can stop them. And it goes down the list. I'll just end by saying, as you all know, this is the second of the huge mass demonstrations against the war, now the occupation in Iraq. The first one was immediately before the war. It was unprecedented. There had never been anything like it in the whole history of European imperialism, hundreds of years, Europe, I include the United States and Canada. There had never been a protest anything like it. This is the first time there had ever been mass popular protest against a war before it was launched. Just to see how far we've come in, say, 40 years. Remember the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War was launched in 1962. That's when John F. Kennedy sent the U.S. Air Force to attack South Vietnam. That's when he started the programs which drove millions of people into concentration camps. That's when he started chemical warfare to destroy crops and to clear the ground for counterinsurgency operations. According to the Vietnamese, there are 600,000 victims of that. And we don't pay any attention to it. We don't count our victims as usual. That was 1962. Was there any protest? I mean, those of you who are old enough will remember. There was so little protest that the event is out of history. I mean, it's literally out of history. Nobody knows it happened because nobody cared. We want to attack and destroy another country? That's fine. It took years before any protest developed. 5 or 6 years later, you started getting protests. By that time, South Vietnam, which was always the main target of the attack, had been virtually destroyed. And then you started getting protests, and it was important. But it was mostly about the peripheral issues, if you think back. It was mostly about the bombing of the North. Well, the bombing of the North was a serious problem, but it was nothing like the bombing of South Vietnam. In fact, it was radically different. The bombing of the North was modulated and planned and careful because it was costly to the United States. When you bombed North Vietnam, you were bombing an internal Chinese railroad. They were bombing Russian ships in the Haiphong Harbor, embassies in Hanoi. You know, somebody might get mad. When you're bombing South Vietnam, no objection at all because they can't resist. They can't do anything. So therefore, they were practically destroyed. To the end, virtually no protest. Now, 40 years later, there's massive protest against wars before they start. And that's really important. Don't think that the planners are unaware of it. You may not study it in school, but they're aware of it. By 1968, after the Tet Offensive, Lyndon Johnson wanted to send 200,000 more troops to South Vietnam. The Pentagon refused. And we know why from the internal documents. They refused because they were afraid that if they sent more troops to South Vietnam, there would be a civil uprising in the United States. They would need them for what they called civil disorder control in the United States, from young people, from women, from minorities, from working people. They just didn't want to send them, and they didn't. When George Bush number one came in, he did whatever he president does. He called for an intelligence analysis of the world situation. A piece of this was leaked, which is very unusual. We never learn about them. But a piece was leaked. Somebody in the Pentagon probably didn't like it. And it was important. What was leaked was a discussion of military intervention. It said that in the case of wars against much weaker enemies, which is, of course, the only kind you'd ever dream of fighting if you have any brains. But in the case of wars against much weaker enemies, the U.S. must win rapidly and decisively because otherwise political support will collapse because it's too thin. It's not like the 60s where you can go on for year after year and nobody gives a damn. That's a change, and it's part of a general change. It's part of a civilizing development throughout the whole society, in fact, much of the world. And it's the result of mass demonstrations, but important as they are, they're only a small part of it. They're important because they inspire people to go on and do what really matters, the day-to-day work of organizing, educating, picking up the right local activities, whatever they may be. And ultimately, that does lead to changes. And it'll continue to. We should be looking ahead. It's just to think what's been. Nobody assumed that the huge demonstrations last year were going to stop the war. Mass actions are really important, but a few of them aren't going to stop a juggernaut. They can throw a wrench in the works. They can slow it down. But they're not going to stop it. If they continue, they can. They can stop it. They can reverse it, and they can dismantle it. It simply has to continue. The guys who run the show have a phrase, complicated phrase, called anticipatory self-defense, which is the new legalism, which means unprovoked aggression without pretext, as long as you can get away with it, as long as it's a much weaker enemy. That's called anticipatory self-defense. Well, you know, we ought to be thinking of that too. We have to anticipate what's coming next, not wait for it. And we have to be engaged in self-defense, but defense of the kind of values that a decent person could uphold with pride. That means defense of justice and freedom, not of violence and domination.
You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts every Saturday morning from 9 until noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada.